Well, this morning, I'm going to begin a two-part history lesson on the context and background of the Westminster Confession of Faith. If you are eager to just dive into it, please be patient. I think this stuff is really important. You know, for the past 2 weeks, I've given some introductory remarks and thoughts, things to be mindful of as we approach the confession and why confessions are important, confessions, creeds, and catechisms, the differences between them. Now, as we sort of get closer to getting into the confession of faith, I think it's very important to set the historical context and background of what was going on when this was written, so that when you then go and read it, hopefully over the years, you'll know what was happening. For example, this was written in a time of war, lots of war. In the midst of war, this confession was written. That has some implications as you think about it. That's important to know. So, and it has to do, again, ultimately, when we're talking about history, we need to, especially those of us like myself who've grown up in the public school system, we really, really need to be intentional and retrain our minds to think about history completely differently than it's been given to us. It's not just simply a series of events that happened in the world. History is his story. It's God's story. So it all matters. The church is central, what God is doing in the lives of his people throughout generations, decades, centuries, millennia. So what we have here, as we begin to look at the history and background leading up to the writing of the confession and what we're called the Westminster Standards, we have some very, very significant things happening in the world, beginning with the Reformation, which is most often, you know, the date given for the beginning of the Reformation is typically 1517. That's why in 2017, if you recall, we celebrated the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. A pretty big deal. It changed the world. It changed the world. Very, very significant. Now, going back to the Westminster Assembly. So let me just be clear. The Westminster Assembly, that was the group of theologians and pastors and laymen who were gathered together, assigned by Parliament to meet at Westminster Abbey in England. That's why it's called the Westminster Standards. That's where they met, and that's where they did their work. So the assembly was called, as I said, once again, by an act of Parliament. So these are just some summary statements I'm going to make here first. The assembly was called by an act of English Parliament in the summer of 1643. So we're ahead already from the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. 1517? We're at 1643, a little over 100 years. This took place during the midst or in the midst of the English Civil War. We're going to hear about that briefly. The first meeting was on July 1st, and they were tasked, this group, this assembly was tasked by Parliament to reform the liturgy and the government of the English church. But also, as we'll find out, that included the Scottish church. Scotland was involved as well. The issues and the challenges that spawned the assembly are rooted in the nature of the English Reformation, which we'll hear about, also struggles within the Church of England at that time, and political struggles between Parliament and the monarchy. So you had English Parliament. That's where we get our system, a lot of our system of Congress. You have the Senate and you have Congress. English Parliament consisted of the House of Lords and the House of Commons. Okay, so Parliament, there was a struggle between Parliament, that group, that body, and the monarchy, the king, who saw all power usually, or if it was a queen, in themselves. So with that in mind, we should not look at these documents ahistorically, but they are rather a part of the progression and the understanding of and development of Christianity born throughout time, okay? So these documents, in other words, to say they're rooted and grounded in actual historical events that have significance and meaning. Okay. So first, number one, if you're taking notes, we have, as I mentioned, number one would be the Protestant Reformation taking place 1517 with Martin Luther. That happens over in Germany, 1517, the nailing of the 95 Theses to the door at Wittenberg, and all that that set off, all that that set in motion, 1517. So you have that event, which begins to spread on what will be called the continent. That's Europe, okay? Germany, France, the Netherlands. England is an island. So number two, number one would be the Reformation. Number two would be, I would call it the coming of Protestantism to England. The coming of Protestantism to England. How did that happen? How did it get there? Because England was very Catholic, very Catholic. So how did Protestant come? And the person we're going to start with is King Henry VIII. King Henry VIII. Who's ever heard of King Henry VIII? Yes, Henry VIII, I am. It's also, he's very noted for having six wives. And there's a nursery rhyme that goes, divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. That's how you can remember his six wives. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. Okay? So Henry VIII, and he was 1509 to 1547. That was his reign. So again, just be mindful of those dates, 1509 to 1507. And then you have, again, the Reformation over in Germany is taking place, beginning. He seeks to divorce his first wife.
Sir, what were those dates of his reign?
1547 to 1553. I'm sorry. I missed that. 1509 to 1547. 1509 to 1547 as his reign in England.
There we go. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. He seeks to divorce his first wife, Catherine of Aragon. And the reason he wants a divorce is she produced him no male heir. Okay? And the papacy at the time, the Roman Catholic Church, is, of course, very much opposed to this. Well, through a series of legal maneuvers involving a Protestant Reformation guy named, who we'll continue to hear about, I believe, Thomas Cranmer, he basically, through an act, declares himself head of the church. And so he gets his divorce, which he wanted, and he also goes on to make changes to the church, to the structure of the church in England. Jane Seymour is his third wife. And she bears him a male heir. And that male heir is Edward VI. Now, Jane Seymour's brother was very Protestant. And so near Henry's death, Protestantism is now on the rise with a new heir to the throne who's being trained in Protestantism. So here is how we get Protestantism coming to England with Henry VIII and his third wife, and their son, Edward VI. Edward VI, next line, his reign was 1547 to 1553. That was Edward VI. Edward VI becomes king at the age of nine, and he allowed for the establishment of Reformed theology in England. He was seen by many, 1547 to 1553. He becomes king at age nine, and with all of the reforms he's bringing to the church, these Reformation reforms, he is seen by many to be a young King Josiah. So Protestants are very jubilant about this king. He has around him certain reformed counselors that are teaching him. Again, one of those more prominent ones being Thomas Cranmer. Thomas Cranmer is a Protestant, and he is the one who introduces what is called the Book of Common Prayer. This is still used, I believe, in Lutheran churches, also in Anglican churches. This is what it looks like, well, at least this version. The Book of Common Prayer. He creates this new liturgy And he writes this book, which is just a series of prayers and different liturgies and scripture readings. He does this all because his goal is to unite the Church of England. It also, the Book of Common Prayer that Cranmer writes, also does away with the Catholic Mass, which was in Latin. And it gives the English a liturgy they can understand in their own language. The Book of Common Prayer, as I said, it moves through set prayers. It has scripture readings and responsive readings. It has this liturgy for every holiday, like Easter and Christmas. Yes. C-R-A-M-N-E-R, Cranmer. Now, here's the interesting thing. At this time, by law, this was the only liturgy that could be used. By law. So you had to use it. So you have here at this time, state power and you have church power. Seen as one and the same, with the king being the head of the church. So the king's the head of the church. The king says the church needs to use this Book of Common Prayer. That's the law of the land. Now, Cranmer also brought in others from the continent. Again, the continent being Germany, France, Belgium. Cranmer also brings in others from the continent to help solidify the Reformation faith in England. Connection to the continental reform tradition. There's some very famous theologians, Peter Vermigli, Martin Bucer. Those names may ring a bell to you going back to Luther. They're invited to assist in implementing the Reformation and appointed, they're appointed to positions or what's called chairs of divinity at Oxford and Cambridge. So they're coming from the continent. They're being put in these positions. So the plan was with these men and others like them for these for them to train up a new clergy in England, a new reformed clergy to help reform the church. So far, under Edward VI, things are looking good. Now, the problem is he's a very sickly child. He doesn't live very long, and he dies at the age of 15 or 16. He dies very young. And with this, the crown now goes to Henry's first daughter. Does anybody know who this is? Yes, not that Mary. Bloody Mary. Everybody heard of Bloody Mary? Okay, so that's who the crown now goes to, Bloody Mary. So Mary the First, here's your dates, 1553 to 1558. Not a long reign, as you can see. She's the daughter of Henry VIII's first marriage. So that's important because since her mother was pushed aside in favor of Protestantism, she, Mary, is very opposed to Protestantism and is a very devout Catholic. And so she reestablishes then under her reign, she reestablishes Catholicism in England. It becomes the official religion of England. And as a necessary consequence of that, many, many Protestants are now martyred, including Thomas Cranmer. This becomes the reign of Bloody Mary. This is why she's called Bloody Mary. Now, note, very important note here. What this also does, though, is very reminiscent of the church in the Book of Acts, when the church faces persecution, because what happens is many of the Protestants then, who weren't killed by Mary, flee. And drives them to the continent and helps solidify ties with the continental reform tradition. Especially you have Geneva, John Calvin in Geneva, and you have a big movement in Zurich with Zwingli. And here they are mentored by these guys. And so when the persecutions of Mary eventually lift, and they do, she had a short reign. It was a bloody reign, but a short reign. When those persecutions ease, these men all come back. But of course, they come back after having spent so much time with the continental reformers. So now they've been trained, and they're put again in leading roles in shaping the identity of the English church for the next generation. So big movements happening here. And again, we're talking about England. This is all going to lead up to this Westminster Assembly and what was going on in the background. So we see, again, Protestant Reformation in England. As I said, Mary's reign was very short. She had no heir. And so when she died, her younger sister, who comes next? Who knows their... Yes, very good. Elizabeth I comes to the throne. There's been a couple of movies on her. Kate Blanchett was in one. Helen Mirren was in another. She seems like a popular queen to make movies out of. Okay, so Queen Elizabeth I, 1558 to 1603. 1558 to 1603. If I'm not mistaken, I'm trying to remember Calvin's first edition of the Institutes. I want to say it was like in the 1550s sometime. It went through some revisions and he added to it. But so you have that going on. He's writing his Institutes. Yes. Very good. And I think it's, is it Boleyn or Boylan? Boleyn? Yes, she is the daughter of the second wife. So we got to remember our rhyme, divorced, beheaded. Oh, okay. So her mother, oops, right. So her mother was eventually beheaded. Okay, so with Elizabeth I, now we swing back and we have a restoration of Protestantism in England. She was, again, the daughter of Henry and his second wife, Anne Boleyn. Boleyn, who was beheaded, she had a personal stake in Protestantism because if Protestantism was not right, if it wasn't the truth, then her mother would have been illegitimate as queen, and that would have made her illegitimate. She produced this or decreed this Act of Uniformity in 1559 in England in order to, once again, unify church practice again under the Book of Common Prayer. So we're back to that. All the churches, once again, had to follow this Book of Common Prayer. She also oversaw a book of sermons. Queen Elizabeth was very opposed to preachers just preaching their own sermons. She wanted a standardized set of sermons. So it was the Book of Sermons, and once again, she's the law of the land. That's what you needed to preach from this authoritative Book of Sermons. Interestingly, has anyone heard of the 39 Articles? If you have a Reformation study Bible, this is where we get the 39 Articles from, not this Reformation study Bible. But she oversees the creation of the 39 Articles. If you do have a Reformation study Bible, it's in the back where all the creeds and confessions are. Very great resource. The 39 Articles, it's a confession. And this is the confession, really, that the Westminster Divines draw heavily from. It's right here. If you've looked at your Westminster so far, you know, you're familiar with how it starts. Very interestingly and very importantly, it starts with Scripture. It starts with God's Word as the authority for everything else it's going to go into. Then it goes into God. The 39 Articles starts with God. Article 1, I'll just read it to you. Article 1 of the 39 Articles of Faith in the Holy Trinity. There is but one living and true God, everlasting, without body, parts, or passions, of infinite power, wisdom, and goodness, the maker and preserver of all things, both visible and invisible. If you're familiar with the confession, the Westminster is very familiar language. And in unity of his God, of this Godhead, there be three persons of one substance, power, and eternity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. So this is being written during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. Yes.
Was there pushback against that book of preaching or whatever it was?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of pushback. We'll get into that. Yeah. I mean, this is all of this is slowly going to percolate and bubble up. Yeah, there was some good stuff. I mean, if you read through the 39 Articles, it's solid stuff. Also, just an interesting tidbit, Cranmer had also wrote when it was the 42 Articles. So they whittled it down at this time under Elizabeth to 39. So if you ever want to impress your friends at a party, you can somehow work that into the conversation. Yes, John.
And just a historical tidbit also, that would be the time that Shakespeare was born and was writing. Was that coming up here?
I had in my notes. You took my thunder.
Yeah.
John stole my thunder. I was gonna do a whole thing there. No, just kidding. Yes, Shakespeare, for context, historical context, this is like the height of his popularity, right? This is when he's in full bloom, right? During Elizabeth I. All of this reform, these changes that she brings back in, including the Book of Prayer, the 39 Articles, is all referred to as the Elizabethan settlement. So remember that phrase, the Elizabethan settlement, because we're going to return to it as different movements come and go. The Elizabethan settlement. So with this, you could say that we have a reformed church, but yet to be fully reformed in terms of its worship, in terms of its church polity. Its doctrine is more reformed, but its liturgy and its polity, and by that I mean, for example, at this time you still have bishops in the Roman Catholic sense. Bishops are around. We'll talk more about that later. But its liturgy and its polity are more in line with the Roman Catholicism of the Middle Ages, okay? This will be one of the main issues moving forward that gives rise to a group who will become known as the Puritans. The Puritans. They will, of course, reject this fixed liturgy, this Book of Common Prayer, wanting instead a more free service that is not prescribed by the government or the state or the king or the queen. That's what they're going to push for. So we could say, let's talk about early Puritans at this time. Early Puritans, they sought a complete reformation of liturgy. They wanted no more bishops. They wanted implementation of a Presbyterian government in line with what was going on with the continental churches. One of the things they wanted too was a stricter observation of the Sabbath. In their view, the Sabbath, it was getting more and more worldly. Christians were more lax. The church was more lax with it. They wanted a stricter Sabbath that they believed did more honor to that day as holy to the Lord. So as we enter now the early 17th century, Queen Elizabeth dies. And if I'm not mistaken, she never got married. And so therefore she had no heirs. So now who does the crown go to? Does anybody know this one? No, I don't think it was her cousin. It goes to James I, but he's James VI of Scotland. So King James becomes the first king of both Scotland and England. He's King James VI of Scotland, and he becomes King James I of England. So let's talk about James. He was raised in the Scottish Reformed Church. And for some reason, I'm sorry, I don't have dates for James. But he was raised in the Scottish Reformed Church. And his mother was Mary, Queen of Scots, another Mary. Now, the Puritans at this time thought that with James, they were hopeful. They thought with James, they can bring the reforms that they wanted to for the Church of England. One of the things they wanted, too, at this time was that church discipline, consider this, church discipline, they wanted church discipline to be a matter of the church alone, because it wasn't. And can you imagine you're living in a society where church discipline, that's the state's territory. That's an issue of the state. Now, interestingly, at this time, you had the church in Zurich, Switzerland, back on the continent. They also held that church discipline should be a function of the state. But in Geneva, Calvin's Geneva, they held that church discipline should be a role strictly for the church. They had the separation of those spheres of government. James more or less upholds, again, the Elizabethan settlement. That's why it's you see that phrase, you know what's encapsulated in that. James pretty much upholds that. Yes, Khalid.
The whole idea of it, state, execute, there's discipline on the people.
Well, I hesitate to use the term separation of church and state because it gets mixed up with our Constitution and what's there. I think for this time period, what's being talked about is the separate spheres. You have the civil sphere and then the king or the state there and how that works. And then the church is its own. Then you have the family, right? I think that's what's being sort of looked at here at this time period. James upholds more or less the Elizabethan settlement. And he, of course, now this gets interesting. Anybody who has a King James Bible, this is the James. This is the James who authorizes a new translation to be made. It's going to be called the King James Bible. And that was in 1611. 1611 was that first authorized. It became known as the authorized. It's the authorized translation. Who authorized it? King James did. Now, this new translation, it would address some of the weaknesses of previous translations. One of those previous translations was the Geneva Bible. However, the translation committee that James put in place was ordered to limit Puritan influence. It was ordered to limit Puritan influence. Now, some of the changes, for example, would be like in terms of retaining certain language, bishop being used in the King James rather than an overseer. Church rather than congregation, things like that. So we have here James generally speaking, supportive of broader Reformed orthodoxy. He did believe that matters of the church, however, he did believe that matters of the church were to be governed by the king or by the state. Okay, we're doing good on time. Now we get to the Puritans. We had the early Puritans. Now we're going to talk about the Puritans. They began as a group seeking further reform of the church, and they developed into this culture and social movement within English society in the 17th century. Main characteristics of the Puritans are a wholehearted devotion to God. All of life belongs to God or is God's. Seeing God in the commonplace. You have the sanctification of work. If you've ever heard of the Protestant work ethic, you know, the man turning the wrench, there's no separation as the Roman Catholic Church had it. You think of a double-decker bus, you know, the common work like that was not very holy. You want to be holy, you had to do priestly work or ministerial work. Not so with the Puritans and Protestantism. They had the Protestant work ethic. Simplicity and sobriety. Their church buildings, if you look at them historically, are very, very plain. White walls, wooden pews and tables. It's not that they were against decorations, but they saw those things as potentially a distraction from the worship of God. Puritan, if you didn't know, was initially, they were called Puritans. It was initially an insult. It was initially an insult. It was not a good term to be called a Puritan. Is basically a way of accusing them of being like Pharisees or something, thinking they were more pure than everybody else. Many of these Puritans became more and more disillusioned with the status quo of the church. They saw it as losing its heart and commitment to God, giving up on certain aspects of theology, not following the Bible closely enough, allowing human tradition to filter in. These are all things we still are concerned with today and need to be. Now, this is very interesting historically. Some of these Puritans at this time, if you're familiar with American history, some of them would leave and go to the Netherlands first. And then where do they go from the Netherlands?
Massachusetts,
right. What was the name of one of the boats? Mayflower, right. Those are the Pilgrims. Who were the Pilgrims? They were Puritans. They're Puritans from England. Why did they come here? Because here's the context. They were getting disillusioned with the church. They wanted reform. Sometimes the reform was coming, but it wasn't what they thought it should be. It didn't go far enough. You had this maintenance of the Elizabethan settlement. So they come to the American colonies. 1620, I believe, they first set foot on English or American soil. 1620. So there's your dates again. If 1611, the New King James, the King James Bible, 1611, 1620, you have pilgrims, Puritans coming to America. And they wanted to do this so that they could, why did they leave? So that they could follow the Bible purely on their own interpretations while others increasingly stayed in England and developed their own culture there. All right, all of that now brings us to the next king of England, who is Charles the First, King Charles, noteworthy king. He is 1625 to 1649, King Charles the First of England. He's the son of James. He is a very, very strong believer in what was called the divine right of kings. Very strong believer in that the king's rule was derived directly from God, that he was above the law. He married a French Catholic, Princess Henrietta Maria. This made the Puritans who stayed, the Protestants, very, very uneasy with that move. At the end of 1640, we see that Charles I has exercised great power over the political elements of society in England. He's refused to call Parliament, which he's supposed to do at certain periods of time. He has this guy named William Laud, L-A-U-D, who he makes his archbishop, and he uses him to help keep down the Puritans, and he challenges Reformed orthodoxy within England. So again, all this to say, there's the turmoil that's happening at this time. Lots and lots of turmoil. All of this is going to come to a head because Charles and this William Laud are going to overstep their bounds. And the way they do that is they attempt to impose that Book of Common Prayer on the Church of Scotland in 1637. And that sets off a war. So now we have war between England and Scotland. So lots of turmoil, political turmoil between the monarch and Parliament, the governmental forces. You have the turmoil with the monarch and the church through this William Laud persecuting, putting pressure on the church. And then in the midst of all of that, war breaks out with Scotland. 1637. A good question. I don't think so. But I don't know. I know James was the first to be both king of both Scotland and England. I don't know if that changed when Charles came to the throne. It's a good question. I didn't think about that. Okay, so we have the war with Scotland. With the new prayer book. This is an interesting little aside here. But when the new prayer book was first used in Scotland, at St. Giles in Edinburgh, the story is a riot broke out, reportedly started when this woman named Jenny Geddes threw her stool at the minister. And of course, she had a stool because at that time there was no pews. You didn't have pews in churches yet. You had to bring your own stool. So she apparently had enough and threw it at the minister, setting off riots. And then it just went downhill from there. Charles I and the Civil War is what we'll look at now. Charles I and the Civil War. A long parliament was called in late 1640 by Charles because he needed funds to wage this war with Scotland. He didn't have any money, or he didn't have enough money. And so he called parliament to discuss this. And the war with Scotland was particularly with this group called the Scottish Covenanters. Charles I was in a weak position, and the parliament knew that, and they took advantage of this to push for political and ecclesial or church reforms. And at this time, Charles I is more or less forced to go along with that. This conflict between the king and parliament ultimately leads to what will become known as the English Civil War. So there's going to be lots of wars. So right now we have a war with Scotland. I can't remember, I wish I had the dates, but around this time or just before, you had the 30 Years' War that involved a bunch of different countries. 30 Years' War, we have a war here now with Scotland, and then all of these things are eventually going to lead to an English Civil War within England itself. War, war, war. And this is actually, this English Civil War is actually a series of wars over the next many years. And the conflict is ultimately over this. Who will have political control in England? Will it be the monarch or will it be Parliament? And that's the backdrop. That's the backdrop of the main context of the Westminster Assembly. Now, I'm just thinking out loud here. It's also the backdrop, of course, when America begins, because we're dealing, I believe at that time, King George. And there is still disputes going on between the king and parliament. So this is going to last for a long time. So who would have ultimate political control? That's what the conflict was. And that's the backdrop. Briefly, the English Civil Wars, they were a complex affair with parliamentary, royalists, Scottish and Irish forces engaged in frequently these skirmishes, changing sides often, and different alliances. Parliament allied with the Scottish Covenanters versus the Royalists led by Charles I. That's the English Civil Wars. All right, we have 5 minutes left. There's the fire hose. All of this is leading into next week, which will be the actual context of this assembly. Who called them? Who were they? What were they tasked to do specifically? But this is important to know where this comes from. Again, it wasn't a group of guys who just were bored and sat and like, what can we write that really is going to make a difference? No, there was war breaking out all over the place. And these tremendous power struggles happening. That's the backdrop of when this was written. Mixed in with all of that, you have continuing Reformation. You have these theologians going around who are continuing to write. Like I said, Calvin's writing the Institutes in Geneva, right? You have what will ultimately be those who will be at the Westminster Assembly. I mean, some of these guys, you would know their names. They're very prominent theologians, but that's not all. There's also just laymen. There's pastors you would never hear. And that was the point, to have a broad consensus. Any thoughts as you digest? Yes, Ben. Yeah. Oh, for John's Trinity Tuesday, I also have a link to an excellent sort of talk that was given on this. I drew a lot of my information from. And the guy who was giving the talk, I believe, drew a lot of his information from an excellent book on the Westminster Assembly, its history, by Robert Latham, who John and I had to read for our elder training, who wrote an excellent book on the Trinity. Yeah. So Robert Latham has a very well-regarded book on this, on the Westminster Assembly. But yeah, I'd be happy to share that. Maybe I'll include that with John's email. So now you know, you can remember your kings and queens of England. And all this stuff is important because, again, where do we come from as Americans? It's our history too. So it's our history in that sense. But of course, it's also our history, everyone in here, because this is the history of the church. This is God's providential hand through events in history. It's all written by him. Yes, John.
You can see later that how well like Puritan thought does here versus England depends on the king. I mean, so like, I guess the first Puritans got a charter from James the First. Because they had to get that charter from the king
right.
to be able to establish themselves in Massachusetts.
Right.
And then afterwards, like, well, what does the king think of them? It depends on the king.
Depends on the king, yeah.
And so later when George, was that George the Third during the Revolution? I think so, but I can't remember. So by that time, evidently, yeah. I don't want to get ahead of us here.
Yeah, thank you.
That's a...
You already stole my thunder once with Shakespeare.
I will not do it again.
Please. There's a lot of talk about Christian nationalism these days. Boy, it is important to know your history, to know what's already been worked out, what's already been done, what was tried and failed, and why did it fail? So many lessons from simply knowing your history that I don't hear a lot in a lot of the conversations, the historical aspect of these things. So very important. And again, we got to train our minds intentionally to rethink our sort of philosophy of history itself. It's God's history. It's his providential hand working in time in people's lives through real events that he has ordained to take place. All right. There's no other thoughts or questions? All right. Dismissed. Thank you.